Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Vice Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Robert Willard. Also joining us on our conversation is Chuck Pro. Admiral, we understand that you played a role in the BRAC process. Could you give our listeners an overview of this process?
Sure. Al, base closure and realignment is the acronym, and it is literally a process that accomplishes both the closure of bases where we have bases in excess and realignment where we can achieve some efficiencies or realignments that may occur as a result of a base closure. The process is driven by the first BRAC legislation back in 1990, and we've had actually several BRAC processes that have occurred before this particular one. The main driver in this BRAC process was excess infrastructure across the services, Navy no exception. And our foremost goal was to try and skinny down the infrastructure to about our needs, both current day and future. So part of the process is to understand the future operating concepts of the Navy and where the current transformation has been taking us, and then to try and align the infrastructure accordingly. And there are pretty good models and calculations to determine exactly how much infrastructure that would require. So the process was had been undertaken over many months and years in preparation. There are organizations within Navy and all the services that are skilled in our in understanding our facilities and our infrastructure, and therefore added greatly to the calculus of this process to try and get the infrastructure sized about right. And then this BRAC had a new twist, and that was the addition of cross-service groups that were intent on scoping the joint requirement, particularly focused on realignment. So many of the BRAC realignments attempted to bring multiple services together in one location to try and achieve some efficiencies there. At the end of the day, the department hopes that the BRAC process will save taxpayers' dollars and allow us to use that to, in other ways, recapitalize the Department of Defense. And we thought we achieved that with this BRAC process. It was very comprehensive across all the services. Navy hopes to achieve, you know, a goodly amount of savings as a result of it, and also some of the joint alignment we think will be very effective.
Admiral, you used the term infrastructure. Can you just give us an example of what you mean when you say infrastructure?
Yeah. In fact, it's a good question because we often think of the military, particularly Navy, as driving ships and perhaps airplanes and submarines, but we don't think a lot about the infrastructure that it takes to really support that. So some examples might be the education and training facilities that we have to prepare sailors and to prepare our young officers for executing their warfighting missions. Our headquarters and support activities to our headquarters all over the world are part of that infrastructure. We have a good deal of industrial capacity across the Navy where we have depots that repair our airplanes and shipyards that obviously repair and build our ships. Intelligence, medical, supply and storage, technical, it really runs the gambit. So there's a business end of Navy business that contains a great deal of infrastructure not only in the continental United States but even overseas. The BRAC focuses on the United States, that infrastructure, and the changes that need to be made over time as the size of our force ebbs and flows.
So given that range of assets and infrastructure, which obviously is very vast, you talk about things like facilities and you mentioned the cross-service joint services. It would seem that one of the key aspects of a realignment process would be pulling together the right team to be able to evaluate and take a look at all of these. How did you approach this?
Once again, we have experts inside each of the services, Navy is no exception, that are in jobs that oversee the infrastructure that I described. So our bases, our schoolhouses, all of that is constantly under scrutiny, and we know whether or not we're fully utilizing it or less than fully utilizing it at any given time. Those experts were rolled up into the BRAC process and were really central to the BRAC process. Those of us at the higher levels that met on BRAC were really trying to establish sort of the strategic overview approach to the problem and then to monitor the outcomes as proposals were made, rejected, or accepted and came forward, so that the package that we ultimately approved was a coherent one, both from the standpoint of Navy and from the standpoint of our responsibility to the joint force.
Admiral, one last question on BRAC. This was the first effort that really included a joint aspect of BRAC. Is that correct? And what are the significance of that?
Yes, Chuck, it is. I think Secretary Rumsfeld wanted strongly for this BRAC to deal with joint issues. We were making a lot of changes, both in terms of size and shape of our military, as well as our posture globally. As you'll recall, we're bringing back Army from Germany and also Army from South Korea. So we had a lot of moving parts that would be affected and would affect the BRAC process. Achieving a synergy across the joint forces in training aviators, in the schoolhouses that we have in common, and in some of the supply and logistics and business activities that we have in common was an important element not only of savings but also of enhancing jointness, you know, taking us farther on this journey to become a fully engaged joint force. And I think with that impetus behind the BRAC, we were able to focus on areas that we could conceivably take into a joint venture. And frankly, there were a lot of things nominated that just would not achieve the kind of efficiencies and savings that we had hoped for and were rejected in the BRAC process, and others that we thought would be very effective. So where we are most common in our business practices were the areas that were, you know, lent themselves to that joint approach.
Very good. Thank you. Let's talk about the process for developing future requirements for the Navy. How did your experience as Director for Force Structure, Resources, and Assessment on the Joint Chiefs of Staff affect your views on future Joint and Navy requirements?
The assignment as the Director of J-8, the Resources and Force Structure element of the Joint Staff, was my second experience on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And as a result, it was exposure this time on the programmatic and budget side and requirements side to the joint force. And as you're probably aware, in those assignments, we are a joint staff. So many Army, Air Force, Marine Corps officers working with me in that endeavor. You learn to appreciate the joint approach to requirements. You learn to understand the interdependencies that we have in supporting one another in warfare and how that is affected by what we buy. So the future capabilities are generally achieved in our force by not only the principal service investing in that capability, but also the other services investing in complementary capabilities so that the end result is, you know, is bigger than any single services investment. That joint approach is what I think I walked away from that experience with and into the Navy staff. And frankly, I felt that Navy could be more joint. In our approach, we were very much internalized in our programming effort and our view of the world. And there is a broader view of the world in enhancing joint warfare writ large. So what we as Navy supply to the maritime component commander within the joint force has to not only service his needs but service the needs of his fellow component commanders as well. That perspective I've tried to help impart to the operation, the OPNAV staff, the Navy staff, and we're realigning to that effect and actually trying to align ourselves to more closely work with and exchange information from joint staff.
Very good. Thank you. We understand that you also played a key role in the recently published Quadrennial Defense Review. What was your role in this process?
All of the vice chiefs across the services participated in QDR and as principals for their service. We spent more hours than I want to think about each week working the QDR process, and much of the time was spent around the table taking briefs, discussing important shaping changes for the Department of Defense. And we sat at the table with the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the deputy secretary of defense, and the principal undersecretaries. That group is still convened, actually, for purposes of assisting in BRAC implementation now. But that was the main focus. It was this smaller group that attempted to frame the arguments that would be taken to Secretary Rumsfeld, the chiefs, the combatant commanders, and his principal secretaries to propose the shaping changes for our military.
Thank you. How did you ensure that the Navy was well represented in this process?
I had a pretty sizable QDR staff helping prepare me for the series of meetings and also working at the action officer level within the Pentagon, both in some of the underpinning modeling simulation, the analysis piece of QDR, and also on a number of different focus groups where they were attempting to tackle particular QDR problems with their other service counterparts and Office of the Secretary of Defense counterparts. So there was a great deal of activity in support of each of the services and the efforts that the vice chiefs were making at the table.
We understand that this process unfolded over the course of many years. How did you track your progress against this, and how did you know when you were finished?
I think that's actually a good characterization, and Secretary Rumsfeld would have liked to hear it because he feels, I know strongly, that he started the department on a journey to transform, to reshape itself and become this much more agile and responsive force, Navy included, several years ago, back in 2000. And obviously 2001 gave us a focus to further reshape ourselves. And it's been more, I think, a journey than any single QDR would affect. The intention is that this QDR leverage on the work that's gone on over the past several years and inform the work that will go on for the next several years before a next QDR in order that that the effort that we made, the concerted effort over this past year to reshape the military, will actually see itself in program changes across the services and in business practice changes across the department and even in governance changes and other things that we think are all of value. So if you've had a glance at the QDR report, you know that there is a very strong emphasis on the current long war, the war on terror, and how we're going to tackle that as a department. We've moved resources to try and invest in the right things that will help us build a force that can tackle that long war. And at the same time, we focused on conventional warfare and our ability to see a recapitalized Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps that are better shaped to deal with future threats. So the world is a very dynamic place. I think clearly this Secretary of Defense desires that we adapt ourselves to those dynamics, and we think the QDR accomplished that this year.
Great. What are the Navy's 2006 priorities? We will ask Vice Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Robert Willard, to explain this to us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.